dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. I'm very pleased to have with us a man who is following these matters closely, writing brilliantly, speaking out lucidly on them, and always a great guest for us here at Secure Freedom Radio, Dr. Sebastian Gorka, now the editor of Breitbart's publications for national security matters. Seb Gorka, welcome. It's good to have you with us, sir.
It's wonderful to be back on the show, Frank.
Thank you. Let's start with an encounter that you had recently, a meeting with the Russian ambassador to the United States. You aren't at liberty to say much about what he said, but I thought you quite elegantly filleted him by talking about what he didn't say. Tell us what you made of his appearance and where it sort of puts us at the moment with respect to the drama playing out under our noses in Ukraine.
Right. Well, I was delighted. I was surprised and then happy to accept this invitation yesterday to a lunch with the Russian ambassador. When I got there, I was told it was all off the record. So I decided, okay, I can't speak about what he said, but let's talk about the things that he avoided. So what does this individual who served in the United Nations representing the Soviet Union in the 1980s, so we know what he really is, what this individual commented on by omission. And in the article, the first thing I point out is I would have loved to have asked him and get him on the record on how is it that the Russian troops deployed in Crimea and then eastern Ukraine are doing so without any kind of unit insignia or designation of the country for which they are the armed forces, which is in a direct contravention of the Geneva and Hague laws of war. So how is it that Russia thinks that suddenly they are permitted to breach the Geneva and Hague Convention? Secondly, this oft-used analogy that the Kremlin has been pushing, that they did nothing wrong in the Crimea because that's just what America did in Kosovo, and so we shouldn't be complaining. The problem with that analogy, which he didn't discuss, is that after NATO, not America, but NATO and America as well, deployed against the Serbian assets in Kosovo, we did not make that protectorate the 51st state of America, unlike Russia, which has swallowed Crimea. And then we have the last point, which is the Russians are very proud of the 97% approval rating in the referendum amongst the Crimeans to reattach themselves to Russia. And the only comment I had in my article is, I've spent many, many years, 15 years in a post-communist former dictatorship, any election, whether referendum or not, in which you get up in the 90s, that's usually only something you heard Saddam Hussein or Hugo Chavez be proud about. In a democracy, anything over 60 or 70% usually indicates that the election has either been rigged or the result of intimidation in the Crimea. It's probably both.
Let's broaden the lens a little bit on the role that we're currently playing at the moment, Seb Gorka, in Ukraine. We've had the commander of U.S. forces and NATO forces, General Breedlove, issue some very stern warnings about what he thinks is going on and making no bones about the fact that it is Russia that is behind all of this. And yet, to date, what we've principally done is deploy some number of helmets and the like to Ukraine, meals ready to eat, and about 150 troops in each of four countries. Is this sufficient to deal with the kind of threat that is now emerging from Putin? And talk a little bit about your thoughts on, you know, the Putin's way of war against that backdrop.
Right. Let's remind ourselves that the first thing we need to understand is what's the strategic culture of the Kremlin. This is a lieutenant colonel from the KGB. So he in his mother's milk, sucked on the art of subversion, of indirect warfare, in using means other than direct kinetic assault to realize his goals. And that's really his playbook. A fascinating report was published by the Latvian Defense Academy on Putin's way of war. And it really does emphasize what he's doing now and what he is intending to do in the next phases. And the way the Russians are approaching conflict now is to achieve your goals without necessarily having to get into armed conflict. This is what Sun Tzu called the ultimate victory, winning without fighting. Instead of annihilating your target, encourage the inner decay. De-emphasize the use of kinetic weapons in favor of cultural war. This is a fascinating approach because you could say this is exactly what Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood are doing to America, for example, internally. Don't look for direct destruction of your enemy, but influence their mind, influence their actions. As we see, our response does not understand the nature of this warfare, because this kind of war is fundamentally reactive. Putin will only stop if we make him stop.
Let me turn to another subject on which I think there's a similar kind of cluelessness. I caught a bit of your interview on Al Jazeera America the other day, an outlet that I don't frequent myself, but I'm delighted to have seen you holding up so well there. In connection with the issue of whether the disbanding of the so-called zone assessment unit of the New York Police Department was advisable or not, you made very strongly the case that it was most ill-advised. Talk a little bit about where that leaves us. For example, as part of the larger effort, it seems, to see no evil or understand at least nothing about the enemy we're confronting, even here at home.
The fact is that the political elite in New York after 9/11 made a very justifiable decision. They said the federal government has let us down. Thousands of New Yorkers have been killed because the federal intelligence agencies didn't do their job. So we're going to do it for them instead. In the last 12 years, they've built an incredible counterterrorism capability with a much strengthened intelligence division, which included this originally called demographic unit, which was used to analyze and understand the Muslim communities in and around New York, where the jihadis would hide, where they would organize, and where they would plan attacks. And with the new political elite, with the new mayor and governor in New York, it was disbanded 2 weeks ago, following the Obama administration's narrative that this is un-Islamic, this is an offense to the local communities, and it is not needed. And that they were spying on all 800,000 Muslims in New York, which is quite amusing.
And they also made the argument that there were no benefits accruing from it. So address that point as well, if you would.
Yeah, the former deputy commissioner of the NYPD has gone on record saying this unit had 14 officers in it. So number one, the idea that 14 people are surveilling 800,000 is of course absurd and fallacious. Secondly, the idea that it hasn't led to leads, there is no way to know that unless you hold a classified a clearance and you know what these organized providing to the actual investigators. And we can't know that, and clearly CARE cannot know that either. So it's basically a false argument.
There was an interesting development the other day, yesterday, in fact. A majority of Jewish organizations in something called the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations repudiated J Street. Remind us what J Street is and why this may be an important development.
Well, this is a lobbying organization, and it's a significant one. And I think it's not an accident that this has occurred recently with Secretary Kerry's statement on the potentiality for an apartheid Israeli state. And the decision, really, I think, is a historic one, because it shows finally that there is a level beneath which even a liberal voting bloc will not stoop. And as a result, I think the cohesion or the pro-administration stance of the major Jewish organizations in America is starting to crumble because they see the reality of how little respect is held inside the White House for our most important ally in the region.
Little respect is the least of it, I'm afraid, downright enmity towards it. Zip Gorka, that has to be it for today, but we'll look forward to visiting with you again soon. Thank you for all that you're doing at one of my favorite outlets, Breitbart News Network, and also, of course, at the National Defense University. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, Fred Flights joins us to talk about the curious case of the White House lying about Benghazi yesterday.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.